Blow the horn. Go.
Everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the sole place they play football.
Everything with an attitude.
Alabama, you listen.
He fumbled and Alabama has recovered.
I told you what they were going to do.
Touchdown, Alabama.
It's 13 national championships.
Rose!
I don't give a shit who we're playing.
Nothing they can play against. And make his ass quit. That's our framework. That's our MO with the team.
Daniel Moore, get your canvas ready.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Tom, the offseason is in full bloom. Recruiting, coaching changes, and spring practice is just around the corner. Where do you want to start?
Hold the phone, man. We got to talk about the big game from a few weeks ago.
You mean the thumping we put on LSU?
Yeah, man, the ass-kicking that we called, not once, but on two different occasions.
Well, yeah, I just thought, you know, it played out pretty much as we predicted. Do we have anything else left to say?
We got to take the credit, man. Now's the time so we can, you know, show what good prognosticators we were in calling not only how bad we were going to beat them, but how we were actually going to dominate the game. It's time to take credit.
All right. Tell me what you saw that really stood out to you.
We did a really good job of adjusting after the first game. It's almost like our coaches studied the film. They studied the chess match. They found some new moves, and LSU coaches came out with the same game plan. I was shocked. The only difference is they just gave it to Jordan Jefferson, but how they ran their offense versus how we – both teams did the same defense. Both teams have great defenses. They stayed with their same game plan for the most part, and they're like, we're so good that just try to beat us. But from an offensive standpoint, we made adjustments and LSU didn't, and I was surprised. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised, but I was shocked that LSU didn't really try to come out with any new wrinkles.
Yeah, they rolled Jordan Jefferson out, and which I'm not surprised at that. I predicted that, you know, that we'd see both quarterbacks. We may see them both on the field at the same time. And even at the in the second half, when it did start to get a little bleak from their perspective, that they didn't rotate in another quarterback or even try something different. I'm a little surprised by that.
Actually, you probably read today, there was an article today in one of the LSU papers where – some of the players have even started coming out verbally, which is kind of surprising. That crap would never happen under Saban, but they've kind of come out a little bit talking about how LSU should have brought in the other quarterback and given him a shot in the ball game.
Yeah, that can't be good for your program, for that to happen. But I'm going to tell you what stood out to me. And I remember, you know, we spent a minute or two talking about this actually, you know, during the game as we watched it live. But there was a point in the second quarter we were really completely shutting them down. And I've been watching our defensive backfield alignment for the last couple of years. And we were begging them to pass the ball. We were lined up in base defense and they continued to run and continued to run the option and really would not try to pass the ball on us. There was a third down in the second quarter where we come out. I was surprised to see it at this point in the game where we come out in a dime. And the coaches call a timeout, but the ball is snapped. So they're late calling the timeout. The ball is snapped. Jefferson very instinctively takes the ball, runs the ball up the middle. And to that point in the game, he got the first down. To that point in the game, that was their best play from scrimmage. But the timeout that the coaches called, it was too late to stop the snap of the ball, but it counted. And so that play came back. They lined the ball up. They lost at that point of the game the best play from scrimmage that they had all day because the coaches saw us in dime. And that told me that not only were we in Jefferson's head, which we predicted and we had pretty well seen, but we were in the coach's head. And at that point of the game, I already knew that we were going to win. At that point, it was just a matter of the clock ticking out. Because
what was the final score going to be? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so at that point, it is just a matter of, you know, what's the score going to be? And then, you know, let's just revel in the next 45 minutes of this game because this is going to be spectacular.
And even the option, which they had success in the second half of that first ball game, Jordan Jefferson, in order to be effective with that, you know, you've got to draw Courtney Upshaw at you. You've got to make the defensive end commit to the quarterback. And, you know, I remember one play specifically where he was so scared and got rid of the ball so quickly that Courtney actually covered him, and then he still went and dragged down, I think it was Spencer Ware, on the sideline for like a 1 yard loss or no gain. And even the commentators was like, you know, whenever we watched the game after, you know, we got back and watched it on the tape version, they were like, you know, how can this be? You can't let the defensive end basically play the option by covering the quarterback and the running back.
And the runner.
Even what they had success with in the first game, they didn't even execute that well. Jordan Jefferson looked like he just was scared to take a hit.
Well, and that's where we predicted that we would be in Jefferson's head. And in no small part do I attribute Dante Hightower's work in the first game, where he hit Jefferson every chance he had, even if it was just a whisper after the pitch or a whisper after the throw. He made sure that he parked Jefferson every chance that he got. And Jefferson made a point of saying, that was the most physical game that I've ever played in. And he could very clearly and distinctly say that because of the play of Hightower. And I think Hightower only got to him once, physically got to him, but he mentally got to him a week before the game. And for Courtney, who's physically abusive as well, you know, to quarterbacks, for him to be able to play both ends of the option just speaks to the physicality and Jefferson's really just being afraid of getting hit.
I was even surprised that they didn't even try to even use Russell Shepard. I don't even remember seeing Russell Shepard in the game at all, just to talk about that for a quick second. I mean, he is somebody that at least had one big play on a broken play, you know, down to our 5 yard line in the first ball game. And I don't even think he recorded a catch. And so your two biggest weapons, you know, Reuben Randall and Russell Shepard, you know, one of those guys didn't even play in the ball game. I don't think if he did, he didn't play that much.
It's a long list of folks that you could say that they did not try to incorporate into the game. As much talent as they had, and we spoke to a number of them, as much talent as they have on that roster, they attempted to go to very, very few of them. You know, tight end is someone who's been publicly talking about how he was an integral part of their offense all season, and certainly an integral part of their offense preparing for that game.
And he had one catch.
And he was targeted, I think, just the one time as well. So there's some dissension down on the Bayou, which certainly doesn't speak well. You know, I went into the game saying, I certainly hope Alabama wins for the sake of, you know, that's our team. But, man, I hope they win so LSU doesn't win two in a row, because I had them as the odds-on favorites for next year in a, you know, not to be too cliched about, you know, Saban processing teams, but I wonder if there's not something broken now in this LSU team.
Well, you know, there was an article today or in the last week talking about, was Les Miles Saban's next victim? And is he about to go off the deep end like Urban Meyer did? Which is very interesting, because they really just, I don't know what the game plan was, but you only had three receivers catch the ball for LSU. And Reuben Randall, you know, he only had three catches in the ball game, and so he was shut down again. You know, Jordan Jefferson, you and I talked about this in the first game, and we said if we could just get up by a touchdown and make Jordan Jefferson have to be a passing quarterback, it would be all she wrote. After that first game, I had never witnessed a game where we had missed four field goals. Well, David, I've never witnessed a game where we've attempted as many field goals as we did in this ball game. So I guess the only thing I will say is, while we did thoroughly dominate them, you know, it would have been nice to not have to attempt seven field goals and to have punched in a little bit more early to really make this a good ass kicking.
No, that's true, but I'm going to take that even as a further metric of our going back and breaking down the film and really calling it. In the first game, every one of our field goals, we gained yards, and then, you know, we gained, you know, as far as we could drive on them, and then lost yards before we kicked the field goal. So every time we had to kick, you know, a 45, 47, 52-yard field goal, and that's not a given anyways. And then when you're in the kicker's head, you know, forget about it. We made some bad decisions, I think, in terms of the kicking. In the second game, we were kicking 30 yards, 32-yard, 35-yard field goals, and I kept elbowing my wife every time. And, you know, when we lined up to kick, and I said, we're in Shelley's range. We're in Shelley's range. That is the most significant difference. And to the extent that I'd rather see touchdowns than field goals, okay, clearly that's the case. But in terms of us calling it, we were spot on. It was happening just like we predicted the first game should have gone if we did not lose yards every time before we attempt a field goal. And so we were in Shelley's range. Now, hell, as many of them as he kicked, he's going to miss one just because just the sheer numbers of them. You know, you're not going to. And so that happened. But, you know, I don't know. I thought it was a pretty good bookend to the first game. And it really did demonstrate we should have beat him the first game.
Oh, it did. And it also demonstrated just that we made adjustments. Because like you said, it was like the coaching staff was hell bent that we were not going to be in Cade Foster's range.
We went for it on fourth down once. A faker went for it on fourth down to prevent that from happening.
Right, right. You know, and you talked about Marquise Mays, and not only, you know, because there were people going into this game that said Marquise Mays was the key for us on offense and that LSU was going to put their best corner against Mays to shut him down, and they were going to then put safety help over the top. And by blanketing him with two guys, they were going to take him out of the equation. And then they felt like the LSU secondary could cover the rest of our receivers, you know, man on man. And there were people that went into this ball game and felt like, you know, our tight ends are not capable of making plays. And, you know, not only did Mays get hurt, and so he came out of the game plan, not only did we then be able to distribute the ball to seven or eight different receivers, but, you know, our tight ends caught 11 passes. I was pretty impressed by that.
I think two different things there. I think if someone did not expect that our tight ends could make plays, then they've not studied their film, because our tight ends have made plays, you know, throughout the season. A couple of them have definitely proven themselves capable receivers. But I'll go the other side on Mays, and you never want to lose your best player. And so I'm not advocating this as strategy, you know, necessarily. But when you clearly have your number one receiver and then just other guys, and you take out Mays, and so they have this weapon in Claiborne that we're going to, you know, put Maurice on their best receiver. Oh, now all of a sudden Mays is out. Well, where do I put this weapon? I have this weapon that can shut down a receiver. I don't know which of these other guys I need to try to be shutting down. And that's where we were able to work the ball to the tight ends, and Norwood had his game. And of course, you know, you always have your Darius Hanks. And so we have this weapon. We don't know where to go. We don't know what to do with it. And so they take away Hanks for a little bit. That's fine. He's typically only good for a couple catches anyways. And I wonder if in some screwy way, if that didn't make it easier for us to spread the ball around.
Yeah, because his talent set was so far removed from the other guys, and that's a good point. And just to mention the tight ends for a minute, this is something I guess I want to highlight with my tight end comment, is not only did we not want to have negative plays, like you talked about a minute ago, but, you know, offenses against good defenses always want to stay in second and shorts. Well, Brad Smellie had 7 catches for 39 yards. He averaged 5.6. Chris Underwood on his 2 catches averaged 6 yards. Michael Williams on his 2 catches, 5 yards. So the point I want to make there is those 3 tight ends with 11 catches, they still average respectively 5 or 6 yards. But what did that do? That made it 2nd and 4 or 2nd and 5. And that allowed us to really open the playbook. And then Darius Hanks had his 5 catches for 60 yards. Oh, what did he do? He was just Mr. Reliable converting some 3rd and 4s and 3rd and 5s. And so, you know, when you look at those tight end stats, you're like, gosh, they only averaged 5 yards of completion. But you know what? That kept us with the ball, and that allowed them to only have 24 minutes time of possession.
Yeah, I'll take 5 yards of completion every play, you know, because it's moving the ball, it's moving the chains. And we put up a graphic after the first game that demonstrated the drive charts, you know, Alabama and LSU drive charts. And looking at those, the charts from the first game, it was very clear that Alabama should have won the game. Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the drive chart from the second game, but good God, the time of possession is just evident just looking at this chart, and just the sheer dominance that we put on them looking at this chart is just amazing. I'm going to make sure that it's in the show notes for this podcast as well.
One other thing, I have not had a chance to look at the drive chart, and so that's interesting that we've got more red on it than we did the first time. One other thing that I want to point out real quick is not only did we lose Marquise Mays, which was so integral in offense, but two more things to point out real quick. You know, we can also talk about the loss of C.J. Mosley, because he's also an integral part. And so, you know, how many teams can lose two big players, one on offense and one on defense, and still spank a team like we did?
Yeah, and that's a great point, and that definitely speaks to the depth. You were spot on from the start, and I knew that this would be the case, where we did not switch out Jarrell Harris for Mosley, that we kept with our base, and we played a ton of base defense. I mean, we were begging them to try to throw the ball is the way I felt about it. And, you know, of course, you know, they didn't do it, and so we stayed in base. You know, we were just pounding them and just beating them. And so Mosley did not play a whole lot, but we have talked him up to great length. You know, horrific that he was injured, but, you know, the mother of ironies that he made one of the biggest defensive plays with that interception, and that's where he gets hurt.
Talk a little bit about, for the people that weren't there with, you know, with you and I in person, I think we also got to talk a little bit about Christian Jones. You know, when you talk about calling your number and what was done by Kevin Norwood, I want you to tell the listeners your comment about Christian Jones.
Yeah, Christian Jones is an amazing, you know, player. He's a true freshman. In the first game when Mays got a little dinged, I guess two games against LSU this year, Mays has gotten dinged up, and Christian came in cold and fielded punts in the first game, and he essentially did that again in the second game. And then he had a pretty significant return to get the ball, some good drive start there. He is going to be a player. I think that as he gets more reps and more opportunities, in my book, he has proven himself as the man to beat at the punt return position.
Well, I think that one punt return that he had and then that good kickoff return, you know, from a momentum standpoint, the game was still close, and teams can get down when they lose a player. And for Jones to step in and make that big punt return right after Mays had gone down, I think it did give the team a little bit of a lift of, yep, next man's up, and we're still clicking here.
Yeah, I think without question, he's going to be a player to watch. We've kind of moved him back and forth between, you know, is he going to be a defensive player in the backfield, or is he going to be a wide receiver? I can't answer that question, but dude's going to be a punt returner.
What do you think about the balance on offense? You know, we've been balanced all year, and it was freaky how we finished the year, runs versus attempts passing. Once again, nice to see, you know, 34 passes and 35 runs.
Yeah, that is pretty impressive. That's a tribute to the game plan, and my hat's off to Jim McElwain for the work that he did putting together that game plan, managing and executing it, all in the midst of hiring for a new head coaching position and, you know, doing some of that transition as well. My hat's off to Jim McElwain. We're going to miss him, but man, he was here 4 years and he's wearing two rings.
No, that's true. Hey, anything else that jumps out from you from the ball game? Anything else that you observed that you kind of want to mention?
You know, I just remember as we were walking into the dome, you know, I made a point of, you know, it's one thing to sit in front of a microphone a week before the game and have some bravado about the outcome. And we had a little conversation, you know, do we still feel as good about this game as we did a week ago when we recorded it? And I think, you know, pretty specifically, we both did. I had a good time spending some time in Bourbon Street before the game with all the Tiger bait. And, you know, I just had a nice little grin on my face because I felt very confident going into the game. I think I told a couple people that we indeed were Tiger bait, that we were going hunting tonight and we're going to bag our limit. And I think we may have exceeded.
And then the Bourbon Street atmosphere, for those that didn't get to go, it was a little... The participants, the roles kind of changed a little bit with the makeup of the demographics after the ball game, right?
Yeah, if you wanted to call it a mixed crowd, that might be generous before the game. I think it was a little heavy on the Tigers and could not hardly find a Tiger fan in the post game.
I definitely think that, you know, when it comes to prep, and we've talked about this coaching staff and their ability to make adjustments at halftime, I guess my analogy here would be, you know, you talked after this last ball game that we needed another quarter of play to decide it. And so maybe this was coaches coming out after halftime. Halftime was just the first football game, and the second football game was the second half, because we definitely did our prep work and they did not.
Yeah, I think we clearly took care of business. It was most impressive. I'm glad that Trent was able to get a touchdown. And then I think in a game that in two editions had been a battle of field goals. When the one touchdown is scored, I just thought there was some fitting irony that that was the PAT that was missed.
That is true. And, you know, we were sitting there talking in the fourth quarter that, you know, the 15-0 looked good, and we wanted to hold them to a shutout. For those people that, you know, that don't get to watch some of these games. And I do think the 21-0 score looks a little better than the 15-0 would have looked.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the fact that it's only field goals will kind of be lost over time, and it'll just look like a 3-touchdown victory. I mean, it will. I mean, the number, you know, 21 is the number there. You know, I don't know what else to say. It was a phenomenal win. You know, our guys did a tremendous job. They crossed the 50 just barely once. Lost the ball on the next play. It was a thoroughly dominating performance. I was using the word after the game that we neutered them. We emasculated them. And I thought the fact that they still were ranked number two in the country, you know, what does Oklahoma State have to say about that?
Right. You know, one thing I do think that we need to mention real quick that we have to highlight is just the continuing evolving maturity of A.J. McCarron. He played a hell of a ball game, and those two passes he threw to Kevin Norwood that were slants to the out of bounds on the sideline that probably were meant for Mays. I mean, he just dropped those balls with perfect touch right over the DB's hands. You couldn't have drew it better with your hand on a piece of paper than he threw those two needles to the sideline.
Yeah, McCarron's growing up, and we've kind of charted this, you know, through the season that he's progressing, he's getting better. He reached a point in the season where he kind of plateaued, but that's going to happen for a first-year starter. There was some discussion around coach just, you know, telling him to relax and bring back some of that fiery emotion that he had at the beginning of the season. I think with the season under his belt, he probably could have that fiery emotion, but have it, you know, controlled a little better at the end of his first year. And he just went out there and executed. And it's pretty exciting to think that he may be one of the better quarterbacks now in the SEC. For all the grief that he was given in the preseason.
It goes back to the stats of what Saban's looking for. Hey, man, complete me 20 of 30 with no picks for 200 yards. And if you get a touchdown, great. If you don't, I'm okay with that. That's just the epitome of what he's looking for.
Yeah. You got any game balls you want to give away from the championship game?
You know, the first game ball I have to give is going to surprise you a little bit. But I have to give a game ball to Jarrell Harris.
All right.
If you would have told me that coming out of this ball game, he would have been the leading tackler on our defense with the players that we've got, with everything that we've talked about and everything that he's been through. You know, we played a lot of base, so he had a lot of opportunities to make plays. But he finished the game with 5 solos and 2 assists, and I think he did himself well as far as his legacy and what he meant to Alabama, that when it was time to shine, which was a small moment, he still shined.
Oh, he did. Who else you got for mini game balls?
I think on offense, we've kind of alluded to A.J. McCarron, but I really think that the game ball on offense has got to be Kevin Morwood, and I'm probably stealing yours. And, you know, the headliners, you know, Brad Smelly could have got it, Hanks could have got it, Michael Williams could have got it. But if you look at losing Mays like we did, with the game plan that we had, they didn't call DeAndre White. They didn't call Kenny Bell's number that many times. They called Kevin Norwood. And had he not made the plays he made and caught the 80 yards worth of balls, it probably still wouldn't have determined the outcome, but it could have definitely been a much tighter ball game.
No, I completely agree. I've got 3 game balls I want to give out. And, you know, Norwood, clearly, for all the reasons that we've talked about. Christian Jones, again, clearly for the reasons that we've talked about. We don't typically give away a special teams game ball, but Christian Jones is getting one for the championship game. And on defense, I'm going to go, for reasons already, you know, I've already talked about, I'm going to go Dante Hightower. He was in Jefferson's head from the moment, you know, it was announced who the combatants would be. And I think that he had an impact on the game that is not going to show up in a stat sheet. He's going to be a player that we miss because he's a thumper and he's the middle linebacker calling the plays. He's going to go on and have a very successful career in the NFL. And we're going to be proud to say that that guy played at Alabama and won him a championship because he was not able to play in the 09 because of the knee injury. So I'm glad that he was able to be on the field for this game, and he'll wear this ring with a little more pride probably.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, man, I enjoyed going to the game with you and watching this thumping, and it was just nice that the Cards, you know, fell like they did so that we got to get another chance to really show what the nation already knew the first time, but I'm glad we could put an exclamation point on it.
I completely agree, and I'm not mad at Pat O'Brien's either. Let me change gears on you. We talked a little bit about Jim McElwain. We've got some new coaches coming in and out. Mac is one, and Sal leaving is another. Why don't you pick one and talk about that coach and his replacement?
You know, I guess I'd have to first start with Sal. Saban's creating his own tree here. You know, you had the Parcells tree and the Belichick tree, and man, Saban's growing a bunch of roots. And, you know, Sal's been with him a long time back in his days as a linebackers coach at LSU. And he obviously, you know, has coached some good players in, you know, at Carolina as well. I just hate to see him leave. I hate to see this whip swap. You know, we can talk about Lance Thompson in a minute, but if I had my choice of Sal versus Lance, I think I'd prefer to keep Sal. You know, the two teams I hate the most are Auburn and Tennessee, and that'll always be that way. So to lose a coach to Tennessee and gain a coach back from Tennessee, I'm not all that crazy about that. I know it's a business to them. It's a job like it is to you and me, or if we had that job, but I don't like that swap.
No, I can't say that I like it either. I hated when Lance left. You know, this will be his third tour of duty at Alabama. And so when he left Saban's staff, he coached under DeBose. When he left Saban's staff and went to Tennessee, I was very miffed about that. He's a top-ranked recruiter, and I thought that potentially we were taking a step back from Lance to Sal, and oh, the irony that Sal is going to Tennessee to get the defensive coordinator job position that Lance interviewed for and was unable to get, and so he decided to leave town. So now we're getting the swap back. A couple of years ago, I would have been happy with it, and I'm a little less happy now. Although Lance Thompson is a fantastic recruiter, his last year at Alabama, he won National Recruiter of the Year. Oh, by the way, Jeremy Pruitt just won National Recruiter of the Year. So we have out of two of the last four National Recruiters on the Year on our staff, which is a Saban staff. So, you know, you got to think we've got recruiting locked up for the next period of time. But Lance Thompson's a career linebacker coach, and I don't mean that necessarily derogatory. I wish I could claim that and cash those checks. But, you know, Sal's moving on to become a defensive coordinator and has interviewed for head coaching positions. So I think it's not a bad swap, but I think I'd rather have Sinceri.
But I think it's important to note there that when Lance Thompson was here, the second tour of duty, and by the way, what other coach can we think of to try to stump ourselves? We'll have had three tours of duty as an Alabama coach. I don't know of any.
Homer Smith, I think he may have had three separate tours of duty, but I know at least two, maybe three. But yeah, you're right. Who else has done that?
Well, I think when Lance was here on the second round of duty, I just didn't see the development of the linebackers the way I have with Sal. I've been very impressed with what Sal has done, specifically his development of Courtney Upshaw. Courtney Upshaw has made tremendous strides in the last 2 years that I just don't think he would have made with Lance Thompson as his coach.
Yeah, and that's a good point. So we'll have to track to see, you know, how we get the development in some of these younger linebackers. Might also be interesting to see how, if we go to more of a 4-3 as opposed to a 3-4, you know, because I do think we have some good coaches at the line position. So, you know, that'll certainly be interesting to see. A little prediction here, though, you know, because Doug Dooley's on a little bit of a hot seat at Tennessee. And so Dooley coached at LSU with Sal and under Saban. You know, you have to agree with Sal going because, you know, even with the potential, you know, one more year on Dooley's contract or Dooley's opportunity, Sal's got a 3-year contract for 2.7 that's guaranteed. So if somehow he finds himself looking for a job next year, he's still got some guaranteed pay. And I wouldn't be surprised a year or two down the road if we don't have Dooley or Sunseri, one or both, back on our staff.
That would be nice. What do you think about losing McElwain?
Well, I hate to see McElwain leave. I would have predicted that Kirby Smart would have left before McElwain, just because I thought he would have gotten the better opportunity sooner. But McElwain's a hell of a coach. We ran through some of his numbers and some of what he's delivered to the program in our pregame show. I won't necessarily exhaust those. I wish him well in his endeavor at Colorado State, and I hope he's met with much success. But Doug Nussmeier, I'm excited for what he can bring to the program. We plucked McElwain from Fresno State. He was the offensive coordinator. And when McElwain left Fresno State, it was actually Doug Nussmeier, who was the quarterback coach at Fresno State, that stepped up to become the offensive coordinator. So there's a little symmetry there. You know, Doug's replacing McElwain as OC at two different locations. Most recently, Doug was the offensive coordinator at University of Washington under Sarkisian, and he's coached a number of quarterbacks. Jake Locker at Washington. He had a tour of duty in the NFL with the Rams, coached Mark Bulger in one of his better Pro Bowl seasons. And then he spent some time at Michigan State, and a couple, you know, not NFL stars, but a couple quality college quarterbacks that were putting up school records at Michigan State. You know, Drew Stanton and Jeff Smoker both played and matriculated under Nussmeier, who was the quarterback coach. So, you know, all of that kind of balled up together. I think that he may be a real hands-on quarterback coach that can maybe help take McCarron to the next level and help us as we bring in some of the younger quarterback recruits. I'm excited about what he can do for us.
Well, the biggest thing that jumps out to me in that is that he replaced McElwain, because that just goes to show you that Saban feels like he can just plug him in and we won't miss a beat.
And it also just speaks to Saban doing his homework, because, you know, when Nuss was, you know, with the Rams, he was a quarterback coach, and he coached under an offensive coordinator who had coached with Saban. And then Nuss spent a couple of years working with quarterbacks at Michigan State, and Saban matriculated through there. So you know that he still knows some of the coaches and still has some connections there. So it's just ironic that almost kind of every step of the way, you know, and oh, by the way, at Fresno State, it's Pat Hill, and Saban has a relationship with Pat Hill. And so almost, you know, almost three of the four stops in Nussmeier's career, you know, Saban had, you know, some connectivity to him. And you just wonder if, you know, taped to the bottom of Saban's desk drawer, he doesn't have a list of coaches that he'd hired any position. And he just said, you know, next man up. I've been tracking Nussmeier for the last couple of years, so I'm going to go get him.
Well, I think it's important for us to tell the listeners about, you've made a comment to me in the past about, you know, every good coach has got his list, you know, scribbled on a piece of paper in his desk drawer that he can call on at any moment. And I'm sure Saban's got his on an Excel spreadsheet that he looks at on a pretty constant basis.
He definitely, in his spare time, you know, when he's not scouting high school players, he's scouting assistant coaches.
Anything else with the offseason moves? Do you think there's going to be any other moves that hasn't happened that will happen?
I don't think so. You know, there were some discussion, you know, whether McElwain would take anyone from the Alabama staff with him. That appears not to be the case. I don't know that he is. I don't track Colorado State, you know, football right closer than I'd like their head coach now. I don't know if he's filled out his coaching staff, but I'd have to think that if anyone were going to leave, they would have left either immediately when McElwain announced, or they would have left just immediately after National Signing Day. And so no one has. So I don't anticipate anyone following him. Certainly, I don't think anyone's going to Tennessee with Sal. So I think we're stable. I don't see anyone leaving. I think it would have to be a mighty big job to open up at this stage of the game for Kirby to consider leaving. I think we're set. I think we've got our coaching staff.
Well, hey, Mark Richt helped us out with Kirby. We need to send him like a thank you note or something, because we appreciate him continuing to be hot and cold over there to buy us a little longer.
We kidded about it before that it's a bittersweet thing for Georgia fans that they were in the SEC championship, because so many of them did want to replace Rick, but, you know, he wins the East and goes to Atlanta, so you can't fire him on the heels of that. But we get to go play LSU and get stomped, and, you know, of course, that's what happened. So, you know, yet you can't get rid of him because of what he accomplished, but what he accomplished was the opportunity to get buzzsawed.
And for Georgia fans, you know, at least they don't have to face us, because we rotate off with the new schedule. So we can't rub it in their face in person, you know, home and home the next 2 years.
Well, they'd have to dust off those black jerseys, I guess, huh?
We got to talk a little bit about, you know, not only the ass kicking, but we got to talk about the ass kicking that Saban did on the recruiting trail again. Is this the third or fourth number one class he's had since he's been here?
It is the third, and it's the third of four. We spent some time last year, and I feel like just kind of dusting off, you know, material from last year. But we
great to be a Bama fan right now, man. Just enjoy the moment.
You know, this is a fun ride. You know, we spent some time last year when recruiting had wrapped up, and we said, you know, we have finished with, and I think last year was a number three class, and so we had two number ones and a number three, and, you know, we were able to look last year and said maybe there's one or two other teams in all of college football that had finished with a top 10 recruiting class each of the last 3 years. And of those that were in that ballpark, you know, they were finishing with six and sevens and a nine and, you know, upper numbers. And so not only were we the only two or three schools that had had top 10 for the last 3 years, we were the only school clearly that had a top three for the last 3 years. Well, now you just add a number to that. We're the only school that's had a top three recruiting class for each of the last 4 years. And it's not a bunch of oscillating around with twos and threes. It's three ones and it's 1-3. You can't get any more definitive than that.
Well, also, too, let's just spend a few minutes talking about a couple other aspects of this recruiting, you know, because we've been following this stuff for a while. And we talked about years past when we lost some big names prior to Saban. You know, we lost out on Jamarcus Russell, who graced us with his presence to come to Alabama for a couple hours. We lost the ability to pick up Jason Allen, who went on to be a stud at Tennessee. We lost out on an ability to lose the kid that went to Florida. His name's escaping me, out of Alabama, that was a highly touted wide receiver that we lost in-state. You know, we're not losing these in-state guys anymore. I mean, if I look at the top of the recruiting rundown and I look at the Ryan Anderson pickup and TJ Yeldon, you know, teammates in Daphne, man, that's been Auburn's turf for, you know, the 5 years at least before Saban got there. And we're holding on to that Gulf Coast now like we didn't before.
No, it's true. And that is pretty amazing. You know, when we were losing all of those players and just, you know, you could argue just barely missing on so many of them, you know, we just felt like if we can just start to get some of these guys, they're talented and they're seeding other programs that are having tremendous success. And if we can just start to get these guys, you know, we can go on a USC type run. And maybe we thought that was a little, you know, dreamlandish, but, you know, that was the caliber of talent that was just, you know, barely, you know, getting through our fingers. Well, we're getting it now. And it almost goes to show something that we said, you know, 10 years ago, that if we can get those talents, that we can go on a USC type run. Well, what are we in the midst of? We're in the midst of that type of a USC run. It should be an Alabama run. But, you know, most recently, that's who did it. And, you know, now it is the Alabama run. And we're getting that in-state talent. And then we're getting talent from other areas as well. The fact that, you know, we signed 26 guys, 16 on defense, 10 on offense. It's a well-distributed class. And what's impressive to me is 8 of them are January enrollees. And so you got a third of your class coming in January that'll be able to participate and compete in spring practice.
No, that's true. And, you know, also I think it's important to talk about competition. I mean, there were years past, you know, just to date ourselves again, but I'll never forget Dwayne Robertson when he decided to go to Kentucky at the last minute because he did not want to compete with Albert Means. Boy, I wish we'd have never looked his way. But we weren't getting these guys to buy into, if you're the best player, you're going to get a chance to compete regardless of what your year. Are you a freshman, sophomore, et cetera? And so when you look at some of these players that we're picking up, I mean, just take TJ Yeldon for a second. It's like a Trent Richardson story all over again. I mean, Trent Richardson comes to Alabama and Mark Ingram, he knows, is going to be the guy. But Trent Richardson said, my time will come. I want to go to an elite program. Well, TJ Yeldon, you know, he flips from Auburn at the very last few days, and they're asking him, you know, why he did. And he attributed it to the success of Mark Ingram and Trent Richardson and what we've been able to crank out at the running back position. And oh, by the way, you still have Eddie Lacy coming back, who's going to still, you know, have a lot of good carries left in him. You saw flashes of Jostin Fowler. And, oh, by the way, Demetrius Hart was a five-star, too. And so I guess the thing that I want to point out real quick is these five-stars are coming the year after a five-star, and that doesn't sway them at all. They could go start anywhere, and they're still coming to Alabama.
No, they're not afraid of the competition. And you could go back and look at each of our classes in each of the last couple of years. Saban's not been afraid to play freshmen. And you could say for all the talent on the field, some of the decisive step-up playmakers this year, you know, Christian Jones and Vinny Sinceri and Trey DePriest, all freshmen, all true freshmen. And so we're not afraid to play the freshmen that can come in and be ready to play. And that's where you get eight guys coming in January. And now tell me if this isn't a little genius, too, when you look at the eight guys coming in. Two are JUCO cornerbacks, and we're losing Menzie and Dre. Two are wide receivers, and we're losing Mays and Hanks. Two are linebackers, and we're losing Upshaw and Hightower. One's a running back, and we're losing Trent. And
yeah.
One's a defensive tackle, and we're losing Chapman and Gentry. I mean, those guys have the opportunity day one to come in and compete, maybe not for starting positions, but every eight of those guys have an opportunity day one to come in and compete for a rotation.
And that just shows the level of detail that he goes about everything. I know people are going to say, like, man, this is a Saban love fest. Well, you know what? It is. Because the nation gave us grief when Mal Moore was even looking his way. And, oh, how crazy is this to pay him the kind of money you're paying him? Well, boy, it looks pretty ingenious right now. I mean, just how he drives every little thing. Your example right there is just spot on. How many coaches are going to even think through that level of detail and try to find not only high-quality kids, but kids who want to compete and kids that are making the grades in the classroom so that they can leave high school after 3.5 years?
Yeah, I give respect to Scott Van Pelt on ESPN Radio. He went on air after signing day. And, you know, he said, hey, a couple years ago when the Alabama fans went crazy and waited at the airport and all that, when Saban showed up, he said, hey, I made fun of you guys on air. And because I thought, that's ridiculous. How can the guy be that good? And, you know, he came back, you know, just a few days later and said, well, guess what? I was wrong. He's better than you guys thought. I should have been down there being crazy with y'all guys because he's better than we all thought. And, you know, he's in the perfect place. And he is, and his level of detail is spot on, because you just take those eight guys and you match their positions to our positions of need. I think it's spectacular. You know, you could argue that, you know, 10 offense and 16 defense is a little swayed to the defense, but there's three DLs, Alphonse Taylor, Caleb Gulledge, and Dakota Ball, who all played offensive line in high school. And I wouldn't be surprised if one or two of them have, you know, the opportunity to not be in the defensive rotation, but then move over to offense. And so I think you do, you know, you start to see one or two of those guys go over, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got a 12-14, you got a 13-13 kind of split. I think that's what we're going to see before this class completely pans out. You know, it's pretty exciting.
It also, you know, just to speak a little bit as well to the versatility of his classes. I'm sure every coach tries to do this, but he is truly finding guys who are just athletes who can play more than one position. I mean, you remember Mark Barron. Mark Barron did not you know, I came across a newspaper clipping the other day that I had saved where, you know, his senior year in high school, you know, after they were, I think, 0-3 to start the season, the coach moves him from a very successful running back to linebacker, and he just takes off at linebacker. Well, guess what? Once again, we've signed several players like Cyrus Jones and Landon Collins, who are 4'4", 4'5", guys who are 6 foot, 200-pound physical guys that can evolve into secondary, linebacker, wide receivers. I love the versatility that he does with his classes as well.
Yeah, he definitely recruits positions, and he has parameters that he looks for in terms of height, weight, and body types. A lot of real analytical there. And then some of that is transferable when you add in the athleticism of various players. And that does give the certainly the versatility. Hey, I want to be a little wonky here and look at some of the math. We recruited 26 guys. We had 9 of the rivals' top 100. That's more than anyone else. We had 9% of the top 100. That's certainly impressive. we had nine. This is kind of the numbers inside the numbers. Nine of our 26, so 35% of our recruiting class was top 100, and that's based on Rivals. We had 15 of the Rivals top 250, and so 6% of the 250. But we had 15 of 26, so 58%, almost 60% of our recruiting class was Rivals top 250. And so I did some comparison. And if you say nine of our 26, so 35% of our class was top 100. Florida, if you look at the other teams that had the most players in the top 100, Florida had six. That's 26% of their recruiting class. Texas had six. That's 21% of their recruiting class. USC had five. They had a very small recruiting class, so that was 33%. And FSU's the closest to kind of competing with us. They had seven to our nine. That represents 37% of their recruiting class. Our recruiting class was only 35, but they recruited only 19 players. And so we recruited seven more players than they did, and we were only off by just a couple of percentage points. And so we have significantly more depth. And you start to look at some of those guys, or your lower four stars and upper three stars, they're still very high quality players that we've brought in. The numbers bear it out. There's no way that we don't have the number one recruiting class in the country again. And we're just lined up to see more and more of that with bringing Lance Thompson back, who's a top recruiter, Jeremy Pruitt winning the top recruiter in the country this year. We're just set up for, I think, potentially a long run of this.
Well, and we talked about how Saban just keeps the cupboards full. And, you know, years ago, you talked about an assembly line and the ability to have guys step in who you don't remember their name because they've sat on the bench for a couple years, and they step up when they're juniors and seniors, and you're like, where'd this guy come from? Well, that's what is slowly starting to happen. You know, in 2008, you had more guys step up because they had to. So you had guys like Julio who had to step in and just be the guy. Well, I think you're going to start to see guys like a D Hart, or guys like this, you know, guys like this TJ Yeldon, who he might just go on the scout team for a couple years. And then he's going to pop out as a junior and you're going to be like, where's this guy? And they're going to start talking about how highly touted he was coming out of high school. And you hadn't even heard his name in 2 years. We're getting very close to that. And boy, you think this is exciting. That's going to be even more exciting.
We're going to see a lot of that on defense this next year. We're going to rotate in a lot of younger guys, a lot of red shirts, a lot of sophomores that have kind of been hanging out. We're going to see a lot of, who's that guy? Gosh, why was he not playing? Because he plays in Hightowers and Upshaws and Barons and the positions of all of those studs. We're going to see a lot of that, especially on defense this year. And so that's going to make spring practice a lot of fun. You want to come back and break down the top things to watch in spring?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, at that time, we'll have to talk about something that Gary Danielson talked about when he would come and watch these guys, you know, practice before the big games that he was calling. He spoke a little bit to that depth, and we'll have to talk about that story next time because he got a good glimpse as to what these top 20 or 30 guys look like on each side of the ball. And I do think it's a pretty scary thing that they're putting together.
Well, color me teased. We'll definitely have to come back and talk through that and hear what Danielson had to say. Hey, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Thanks for listening. Be sure to drop us an email at alabamafootballpodcast@gmail.com to be added to our mailing list, and follow us on Twitter. And until next time, roll tide.
Blow the horn. Let's go.
Everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the someplace they play football.
Everything with an attitude.
All right.